TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Jeremy Corbyn with Yanis Varoufakis, one of two. Rescuing Democracy by Reviving Socialism. A conversation at the Edinburgh Book Festival, August 20, 2018. Once a year, a tented village goes up in the heart of Edinburgh. The book festival welcomes around 1,000 authors in over 900 events for adults and children. They meet novelists, poets, scientists, philosophers, and activists. The best-attended events of 2018 were political panels on how to curb the power of corporations and banks, and the parallel fights for public education and health, and the resistance against privatization across Europe and the Americas. Yanis Varoufakis is a Greek economist, academic, and politician. He was a Syriza member of the Hellenic Parliament and served as the Greek Minister of Finance from January to July 2015. He resigned in protest over the imposition of structural adjustment and bailout loans on the Greek people. Varoufakis has since appeared in numerous debates, lectures, and interviews. In 2016, he co-founded DiEM25, Democracy in Europe Movement 2025, and subsequently backed a Remain in the European Union vote in the UK's Brexit referendum of 2016. Jeremy Corbyn is a leader of the British Labour Party and of the opposition in Parliament since 2015. He was first elected MP for Islington North in 1983. Jeremy Corbyn identifies as a democratic socialist. He advocates reversing austerity cuts to public services and welfare funding made since 2010, and to reverse the privatization of public utilities and the railways in the UK. An anti-war and anti-nuclear campaigner since his youth, he broadly supports non-interventionism and unilateral nuclear disarmament. Here is Yanis Varoufakis, recorded in August 2018.
Good evening, Edinburgh. Thank you, Edinburgh Book Festival, for this wonderful opportunity. This is the fourth event dedicated to the theme of reviving democracy. And what a way to end it with a theme about reviving socialism with Jeremy Corbyn. You see, ladies and gentlemen, the oligarchy would rather imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. But we must be able to dream of a post-capitalist world as a prerequisite to making a democratic, a properly democratic future possible. To humanize politics, speaking of humanizing politics, Jeremy has already made significant contributions to humanizing British politics. And I shall mention just two before we start the conversation. Firstly, he proved that it is entirely possible through dignity and a steadfast commitment to sincere politics to sidestep the systematic character assassination attempts of the systemic media. And secondly, he proved that the youth in this country and in every country are not structurally apolitical or apathetic. All they need is to see politicians that are sincere, and then they get reinvigorated, they return to the political arena, and they reinvigorate politics with momentum, with the Labour Party, and indeed with the last general election, where the Labour Party, against the prognosis of the establishment, had its best result since 1945 because of the young people. So, Jeremy, my appreciation as a non-UK person, representing a people that have been downtrodden, and who have been crushed by the same oligarchy, which is attempting to put the pressure on you even before you get into government. But they are not going to get their way. I have no doubt about that. Even though the pressures must be extreme, my wife and I have experienced them severally. But how are you bearing up? Because a lot of people are asking me to ask you that question.
Well, I'm absolutely fine, actually. So if anyone from the Daily Mail's here, you feel free to report that. Listen, yeah, there are pressures, of course, and there are abusive remarks and so on made in lots of places. But I tell you what real pressure is. Real pressure is when you can't feed your children. Real pressure is when you're about to lose your home. Real pressure is when you're working in a hospital, you're understaffed, and you've got to make a choice between who's the greatest emergency of a number of very important cases in front of you. And so political representatives have to absorb a lot of pressure, but you've got to recognise the real-life pressure that lots of people are under day in, day out, in a system that is grotesquely unfair, in a society that is deeply divided between the very richest and the very poorest. And surely our message has to be, we cannot afford all these levels of inequality in Britain. We've got to do something about it. And that's the message that we've tried to put, and I put in the general election.
You just reminded me of similar situations in Greece. I was being asked, how can you bear being the finance minister of a bankrupt country? Britain is not Greece. No. And that is a good thing for you and for the Labour Party. Because you have a chance to win the government. And with the fact, given that you still have a central bank and you have a degree of independence and autonomy, a degree. Yeah. No one is autonomous in globalized, financialized capitalism, but you have an opportunity to do things that we couldn't do. But shall we talk about socialism?
Yes.
Because
it's a very good idea.
If Bernie Sanders can turn the good people of Wisconsin into socialists and win the primary election in Wisconsin, I think that we have a duty to return to the scene of our collective left-wing crime that has led socialism to become an impolite word. We need to revive it.
It is about presenting things in a human way and with a human value. It's not about economic and political management. It's about what you're trying to achieve. And that is something that involves and excites people. It's about unleashing that sense of involvement and creativity that's there in all of us. You mentioned about young people and their non-involvement in politics in Britain. True. And in the elections before 2017, the participation of those younger people who had registered to vote was less than 50%, whereas the turnout for the rest of the population was a lot higher than that. And what happened in 2017 was a lot of young people registered to vote for the first time and indeed voted for the first time because they saw in the policies we were putting forward some sense of hope for themselves. Because they had been told, ever since austerity, indeed before that, because the neocon agenda began in the 70s, it wasn't a recent thing, they'd been told that they should expect to be worse off than their parents and their children should expect to be worse off than them, that they would have less healthcare, less pensions, and they'd have to pay for their education. And what we're saying, that education should be a right, not a privilege, not a commodity, that health should be a right, not a privilege, not a commodity, and that everyone in society matters. And so that means looking quite strongly at the education system, which has become, in my view, over-competitive. In the case of the English education system, obsessed with league tables and tick box results, which puts incredible pressure on students and on teachers, and also results in quite a lot of young people being almost failed by the education system and dropping out of academic study of any sort. And so what we're saying is that young people actually matter. Now, it's not just in Britain. Britain isn't unique in that sense. The movement surrounding Bernie Sanders and his campaign in the Democratic primaries in the United States. I mean, who'd have thought that somebody calling themselves a socialist would get within a whisker of winning the Democratic nomination for the presidency. And it'll be the question we'll all be asking ourselves forevermore. Had it been an election between Sanders and Trump, what would the result have been?
Sanders,
I know which one
it.
I want.
Sanders would have won. Okay. 10 years ago, the young were lured by this fantasy, this dangerous illusion that modern technology on its own, you know, Google and Facebook, would create a better society. I find, do you also find the same, that today they realize that these technologies, however wondrous they may be, they are increasingly monopolized by planning systems like Facebook and Google that concentrate financialized capital and in the end turn them into products. At the same time, you have artificial intelligence, and for the first time, young people understand socialism almost instinctively, because they can see that the robots that are going to be producing all those gadgets will have absolutely no need for those gadgets. They will not have any interest, any desire in purchasing them or any capacity to purchase them. So this concentration of capital, which is increasing exponentially, means that capitalism is simply going to produce Uberized labor markets and just comprehensive misery for the very many. Do you find this?
To a point, yes. You can't ignore the incredible achievements of the high-tech world. You can't ignore it. I mean, somebody let me try on one of these face things you put on, and it puts you into a virtual reality world, and you can travel anywhere you like. And so it was Saturday night, so I thought, well, I go to Rio, I go to South Africa, I go to Mexico, I'll come home again. And it was fun, you know. Press, oh, wow, that's South Africa. And it was incredibly realistic what you were looking at within this thing, but it was a complete illusion, a total fantasy world. But then the application of this high tech means that we can achieve far more, you can do far more, you can do far more in medicine and everything else. But, and this is the big but, which you're quite right to draw attention to, the effect has actually been to concentrate power and the agenda in the hands of a small number of very, very powerful companies, and actually make a small number of people incredibly rich at the expense of the rest. Technology ought to be something that benefits all of us in the spreading of wealth. This technological revolution so far has not.
And it is
a question about the living standards of people, right, and what you can achieve with that technology.
But it's also the cultural impact, because Marx talked about alienation of the proletarian, which effectively meant that the worker felt completely alienated from the products of his or her labor. But now you get alienated from the products of your consumption as well, because you know, when two people get together in social media, there's always a corporation somewhere trying to manipulate their behavior in the interests of the corporation. So the technology is fantastic. I can't live without my smartphone. I'm a techie. I'm a science fiction buff. I have to confess to this. I want to live in communism, and for me, the ideal communism is Star Trek. Because you have machines doing all the work, and people have philosophical discussions and they explore the universe. But I fear that capitalism is leading us towards the Matrix.
Who grows the but who grows the food?
Nobody. It comes out of replicators.
No, but look, Star Trek.
He hasn't watched Star Trek.
No, I'm just asking the question. That you're sitting in this high-tech, wonderful world. We're watching screens. Dot dot dot. Everything's happening. Who's growing the tomatoes?
No one.
What do you eat?
They are produced through fantastic technology that can simulate the best organic food ever. It won't be impossible to
do. I ask you that question because you're quite right.
God, and then you can grow your own food as a hobby. You can have an allotment.
That's a good idea. That's a really good idea. Yeah, I appreciate it.
I want to touch upon something you said before about the culture of measurement in our schools, in our hospitals. You will recall, I lived through that in the early 80s under Thatcher in this country. How that happened? Do you remember how that happened? It was when Keith Joseph and the gurus, the Hayekian gurus of Margaret Thatcher, tried to effectively abdicate from having any responsibility for education, for health, and so on, by simulating a market mechanism and implanting it into institutions that could never be consistent and compatible with markets, like the prisons, the court system, the NHS, universities. And I remember how the quality of university education in this country just went down the drain the moment things were valued that could be measured and the intangible things that could not. So effectively, what they did, and as a socialist looking at this, it was absurd. They took the Soviet planning system with indicative prices, the Gosplan, and they implanted it into universities. They did not implant it in the private sector. They implanted it in the public sector. So they took the Soviet planning model and put it in our schools and our systems, with the result that now we have universities that look sparkling and fantastic, and they have all sorts of all singing, all dancing things. But the quality of education in this country has gone down the drain. And I can say that because I'm not a British politician, but I'm somebody who actually studied in Britain, in British universities and schools, and taught here. And I just wouldn't send my child
to a
British university
anymore. But this absurd creation of an internal market in Britain, in local government and in health, meant that you had this notional value of X department, Y department, Z department, and so on. And I was—I remember I was a member of a health authority in the 1980s when this internal market came in. It was utterly absurd, the whole thing. And I said, why on earth are we buying and selling from each other in the same building when they're all employed by the NHS? And of course, I knew the answer to that question perfectly well. The whole idea was that the pharmacy will be run by Virgin in the future. The ambulance will be run by somebody else, and so on and so on.
It was the first stage.
And
first
it was setting was up a market in order to privatise. Yeah. And whilst the principle of the National Health Service is certainly there, the degree of privatisation and with it reduction in working conditions and living standards, so you have a national pay bargaining system within the NHS, of course, it's there, but an awful lot of people are not a party to that because they're working for a contractor going into service. Same with local government and other services as well. Which is why our policies are a combination of recreating the principle of a universal public service like the National Health Service, like the Education Service, but it's also about ensuring that there's real opportunities for everybody, hence the offer we put forward on student fees, and the principle that education should be a right, not a privilege, and not a commodity to be bought and sold. So we will set up a National Education Service on the lines of the NHS.
You know what is interesting? Even the gurus of neoliberal economics recognize that the market fails when it comes to education and to health. Yeah. So this is a very interesting paradox. It's like having the Pope, who's an atheist, and the cardinals being believers. So, the gurus of conservative, vulgar, neoclassical, neoliberal economics would tell you that Jeremy Corbyn is right, that you cannot really run a proper health or education service on the basis of a simulation of a market. But those who are employed, whose salaries are directly connected with the bodies, or corporate bodies, that will benefit from the privatization, that come up with the theoretical neoliberal exegesis of why privatization is a good thing. So you will have to do battle against them. And they are many and very well paid.
But it also has the effect of diminishing the working conditions and pay of those within the public sector as well, because they're always told you've got to compete against somebody else. East Coast Main Line, which runs from Edinburgh to London, has now collapsed twice in the private sector. Carillion, which was largely reliant on public sector or partly reliant on public sector contracts, collapsed, and people discovered actually there wasn't anything there.
And of course, this is a universal story. Speaking of collapsed infrastructure, think of Genoa, the privatized motorway system in Italy, belonging to one family, that makes 3 billion euros economic rent from it and not servicing the infrastructure, with the result, the deaths that we had a few days ago. Since I spoke about Italy, let's move on to an event in June 2016. You were accused of being sophisticated by the media.
Of being sophisticated?
Yes. They didn't put it in those terms.
That's a new one. But I've never heard that before.
you had the official Remain campaign, which was infantilizing the British public with the Project Fear. And you had the official Leave campaign, which was infantilizing the British public with those monstrous claims as to what Brexit would mean for the country. And you had Jeremy Corbyn and some of us who were saying, the EU is a cartel of big business. It's a pretty awful set of institutions, but we're better off staying in and fighting to change it from within in association and collaboration with our comrades, progressives across Europe. That's a sophisticated argument. And you were being accused of not being fully behind the bureaucracy of Brussels, of Barnier, of Merkel, of Hollande. Yeah. How do you feel being accused of being sophisticated?
It's a low blow. It really is. It's a low blow. But yeah, I cope. What we were arguing for was Remain and Reform. There are very strong social arguments for the EU. Very strong arguments on Workers' Rights Directive, on Charter of Fundamental Rights, on its connection with the European Court of Human Rights, environmental protections, consumer protections. Absolutely very strong arguments for all of that. And I would never want to walk away from those. There are also criticisms of the EU on its competition policy. I want our mail system to be in public ownership. There is a competition directive, and there's arguments around that. There are arguments around the competition element within some EU policies, which I think have to be challenged. And so what I was saying was, one is remain in the EU, but we would be a force in the EU for reform of it. And that was the whole point I was making in the campaign. I hadn't heard that I was being over-sophisticated, but I'm...
That's what they meant.
I'll reflect on that.
Because, you know, you had people like Nick Clegg and Tony Blair and David Cameron who were just adopting the EU mantra as if it was sacred. Mm. And then you had the Brexiteers who were saying that Satan had created the EU and it was satanic.
Well, also
and here we were in the middle saying, look, it's pretty bad, but we're better off staying in and fighting within it.
But
that's a sophisticated position to have.
Britain is not in the euro, obviously.
Thank goodness
for that.
But
we saw the way in which the European Central Bank treated yourselves and also the austerity that was imposed on Ireland, on Portugal and Spain.
It's not just austerity. They committed a crime against the Irish people. The head of the Central Bank of Europe put a gun on the Irish Prime Minister's head and demanded that overnight the losses of private investors, mostly from Germany, should be transferred onto the books of the Irish state. And the Irish Prime Minister succumbed. Now, that's you know, robbery. Just daylight robbery. That's what they did.
Yeah, I actually I challenged the whole Maastricht idea, which established the European Central Bank, because it was a central bank based on price stability, not on living standards, not on rights and sharing. It was entirely on price stability.
It was a purely ideological construction, which nevertheless, besides being ideologically quite putrid, it was technically and financially ridiculously stupid. We created a central bank without a state to be the central bank of 19 governments without a central bank. Go figure. But having said that, now we are on the road to Brexit, Article 50 process. We have a government that is completely in disarray. It's a dog's Brexit process from where I'm standing, which is Athens. What are you going to do? Let's say that Theresa May collapses and you move into 10 Downing Street before March.
We would obviously take over the negotiations. We'd obviously look for a substantial transition period, and our fundamental position would be access to the European market. We would accept the regulatory alignment. We'd indeed go further than it, and I'd go further than the European Union on a lot of trade deals. But we would not be saying, look, hang on a minute, if you don't give us what we want, we're going to go off and do a private deal with Donald Trump, which will be about deregulation. It'll be about the diminishing of working conditions, which is happening in the United States, courtesy of Trump and his administration, and we will not be going into that sort of protectionist trade war that he's going into at the present time. So we'd be seriously negotiating with them, And we recognize that there's always going to have to be a very close relationship with Europe. After all, half our trade is with Europe, and so it's, you can't walk away from it.
May I convey to you what our position as the Democracy in Europe movement is,
yeah,
on this transition period? Because there's not a single word of what you said that I disagree with. But to tie it down a little bit more, our proposal would be that you go for as close an alignment as possible for a 5-year period, renewable. Mm. That would mean something like Norway Plus, which would effectively respect the Leave verdict of the British voters, create a period during which nothing much changes except common agricultural policy and fisheries, and it gives the House of Commons breathing space during which to debate what kind of longer-term arrangements you want, or the people of Britain want, between the European Union and the United Kingdom, without a ticking clock, without the gun on your heads as parliamentarians, as a country.
But in the meantime, we've got the urgency of it, that unless they make some serious moves and serious agreement, then there are a whole lot of jobs all over the UK, mainly in manufacturing industry, that are going to be seriously at risk.
But
unless they do something, then there's an urgent situation. The supply chain disappears.
When you say they, you mean whom?
The Tory government.
Oh, the Tory government.
You heard about
the Tory government,
yeah,
will never do anything decent. They will bring a terrible deal back from Brussels. They will not have a parliamentary majority. And my fear is that you're going to end up with a no-deal Brexit. That's our fear, I suspect. And you better make sure that you storm Downing Street as quickly as possible to prevent that.
My preference would be that since they clearly are not capable of negotiating this, they resign and we have a general election
exactly.
We can have that,
second
choice before the people.
You heard a discussion between the Greek economist, academic and politician Yanis Varoufakis and the British leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn. Varoufakis was a Syriza member of the Hellenic Parliament and served as the Greek Minister of Finance from January to July 2015. He resigned in protest over the imposition of structural adjustment and bailout loans on the Greek people. Jeremy Corbyn identifies as a democratic socialist. He proposes to undo the austerity cuts to public services and welfare funding made since 2010. He also wants to reverse the privatization of British public utilities and railways. Varoufakis and Corbyn were recorded on August 20, 2018 at the Edinburgh Book Festival. Come back for the rest of their debate when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.